hppodcraft.com.
July 16, 1833. This is a memorable anniversary for me. On it, I complete my 323rd year. The Wandering Jew? Certainly not. More than 18 centuries have passed over his head. In comparison with him, I am a very young immortal. Am I then immortal? This is a question which I have asked myself, by day and night, for now 303 years, and yet cannot answer it. I detected a grey hair amidst my brown locks this very day. That surely signifies decay. Yet, it may have remained concealed there for 300 years, for some persons have become entirely white-headed before 20 years of age. I will tell my story, and my reader shall judge for me. I will tell my story, and so contrive to pass some few hours of a long eternity become so wearisome to me.
Who wants to live forever? Who dares to dream forever? When love must die.
You know, Chris, I always love it when we start with song, but it's probably not a good idea if it makes me weep openly.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chad.
It's so beautiful. You're, of course, referencing the Queen song, Who Wants to Live Forever, which just from the soundtrack to Highlander.
Yep.
The excellent 1986 film. And if you're not familiar, the Highlanders, they're immortal. The main guy, Christopher Lambert, he doesn't know he's a Highlander. Or he doesn't understand that in the beginning. And, you know, Sean Connery shows up to tell him that, but he doesn't believe him. Because I think when Sean Connery shows up, he says, I'm Spanish or Egyptian or whatever. And he's clearly Sean Connery.
He says he's Egyptian.
Right.
But he's like from Spain. Like, so he lived in Spain a long time.
Yeah.
And now he's moved up to the Scottish Highlands. And Christopher Lambert, not Scottish.
Christopher Lambert's from all over the place. So he just kind of makes, isn't he? I mean, he just sounds.
That's
a
from
little...
the movie. He goes, where are you from, Nash? You talk funny. He goes, yes. Lots of different places.
Well, anyway, yeah, Nash, or I think, what's his name? In Connor.
Connor McLeod, yes.
Yeah. He's in love with the woman, and he stays with her, even though she ages and dies of natural causes. He stays with her the whole time, while he remains young.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sad. And that Queen song really brings it home, and you think, oh, what a guy. You know, he stayed with her, even though she turned into an old woman. Which is hilarious, because I played that same Queen song while I was watching footage of Catherine Zeta-Jones walking around with Michael Douglas. And I felt nothing. I should have been touched by her bravery, but instead I was just like, nope. So,
dude, I was doing a little looking around. I was curious if this story in some way inspired Highlander.
Mm-hmm.
The Highlander movie spawned a television show.
It did.
Which had Mary Shelley on as a character.
What?
Yeah. I'm sure... a Highlander fan out there knows more about it than I do. But it seems like Dr. Palladori wasn't actually Dr. Palladori, but an immortal.
Mm-hmm.
He confided in her that he was immortal. It somehow inspired her to write Frankenstein, even though I would think it would just have inspired her to write this story, because
exactly.
This is so Highlander.
Wow, I gotta watch that episode. I bet Manimal shows up at some point as well. But you know what I want? I want to talk about Mary Shelley forever.
That intro we heard was from Mary Shelley's short story, The Mortal Immortal. Last month we covered Miss Shelley's amazing novel, Frankenstein, and we are having a hard time saying goodbye. So we figured, why not just do another story by her?
Yeah, I think the rest of this month we'll do some kind of Frankenstein aftermath, you know, stories that are somewhat related to it. And this one certainly is, by author and by some of the themes. Our reader this week is a returning favorite, David Wildsmith.
People love him.
David is one of the guys behind the Seven Land Hand podcast. If you are a board game or card game fan, and I know that a lot of our listeners are, tune into sevenlandhand.com. We'll link out to them in the show notes. Before we jump into the summary of the story, that title, The Mortal Immortal, is what in the English business we'd call an oxymoron.
Yeah.
It's an apparent contradiction in terms, like conventionally unconventional or the living dead. Or like George Carlin would say, military intelligence.
That's right, yeah.
Or business ethics. But oxymorons are created intentionally, and they're meant to impart some sort of meaning. And we could speculate on that now, but maybe let's just get into it and we can make some guesses later at what the story title means.
So our story starts off with this immortal who's been around for 323 years. A new immortal in the scheme of immortality, really. And as a longtime reader of Anne Rice novels, as well as a player of the role-playing game Vampire the Masquerade, I feel this subject is one sort of beaten to death. But I wonder, have we ever really discussed immortality on the show?
Probably as an aside, but I don't think we've really ever got gotten into it. Maybe we have. I don't know. We're definitely going to have to digress about that later, but let's just keep going for now.
So our narrator, who is only referred to as Winzy, got his immortality from the alchemist Cornelius Agrippa. Agrippa was a real guy, a German polymath, physician, legal scholar, soldier, theologian, and occult writer. He was also an excellent dancer and really good at playing the spoons. I don't know if you knew about that.
Didn't know.
He lived from 1486 to 1535. Shelley mentioned him in Frankenstein as one of the authors Victor was studying.
And this was the 1500s when this was taking place. Cornelius was always in some kind of trouble in his real life for his occult business.
Yeah.
Had to go from patron to patron and move around a lot. He was also a lifelong defender of women, as it turns out. He spoke out against persecuting witches.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was probably because he understood the dark arts and didn't want to be persecuted himself. But and they say it was to impress a patron. But among his many and various occult and theological works, he wrote On the Nobility and Excellence of the Feminine Sex, which was a work that tried to prove the superiority of women using Kabbalistic ideas.
Well, dude, this guy is such an interesting character. We can do a whole show on him. But I think that this is the most important bit that I read about him. According to the scholar Augustin Calme, Agrippa had a dog that jumped into the Rhone as his master neared death, causing many to believe it was a demon.
People thought he was hanging out with demons, and when they saw that dog make a break for it, I guess they went, that was it the whole time! It was the dog! That's hilarious. Well, I think Shelley really liked this guy, too. Brought him up so many times,
yeah.
Perhaps because of his female forward stances.
Could be.
But I also like the connection to Frankenstein here. One imagines that this is all happening in the same Shelley-verse. I came up with a good idea for a connection. We could talk about it later. I tell you, this Frankenstein fan theory will blow your mind.
All right.
Anyway, back to Cornelius.
Long and short of it, since he was dabbling in the unknown and the occult, people thought that Cornelius was hanging out with demons, the devil, and he was an evil guy. Though some scholars say that he renounced magic like 2 years before his death.
Yeah.
But in this story, people wanted nothing to do with him because he was a creepy wizard.
Most of his life, he was a creepy wizard.
Yeah.
I think when he renounced it too, all he was really saying, people think it might have been coerced, but I think he honestly was just saying, you know, when I was a young guy, I wrote like 3 volumes of a book about magic. Got a little older and I realized none of that stuff works and it doesn't exist and it's stupid. I think that really is all it was. But there in the story here, there was a very Lovecraftian accident that happened. It's, you know, it says Cornelius had an assistant and it says all the world has also heard of his scholar who, unawares, raised the foul fiend during his master's absence and was destroyed by him. So some poor assistant kid was like, oh, I'll read this Necronomicon out loud. What could happen? Yeah, you know. And then Cornelius came back from a taco run. There was blood everywhere. Smell of sulfur.
No.
It was a bad scene. Yeah. So all of Cornelius' servants and pupils, they take off. They don't want to work with him anymore if there's devil rays in the foot. And he's got nobody to help with his experiments. Disastrous for him. I love this line. Experiment after experiment failed because one pair of hands was insufficient to complete them. The dark spirits laughed at him for not being able to retain a single mortal in his service. Yeah. Which seems like, I don't know, dark spirits should be laughing at more intense things. That seems like such a petty, you know, ha, 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 look at that fool. There's nobody to hold that beaker for him. Ha, ha, ha. He hired an intern who called in sick on his second day and then never came back. Evil.
Yeah. So Winzy used to be a pupil of Cornelius and worked for him, but he was away when all this went down. And when he returned, his friends told him not to go back because of this accident. And there's demons hanging around and he's just generally a bad guy. So Cornelius comes over and offers Winzy a bunch of gold if he'll return to work for him. But Winzy just runs off because he's scared. There's something about his person that seems unnatural.
Yeah.
So now Winzy's got this girl from the neighborhood, Bertha, who he's in love with. And they've known each other since they were little. But Bertha's folks died of an illness when she was young, and she was taken in by this wealthy woman who lived on her own. Bertha moved up in the world, but she still managed to see Winzy and his family, because they were, you know, neighbors, even though the rich lady wanted her to hang out with rich men and get married.
Right, her patron wants her to be paired up with somebody more deserving than Winzy, who's poor. It seems like that for Mary Shelley, love only exists if you've known each other since childhood and one of you is a ward. Otherwise, it doesn't work out. And change of fortune seems to be a theme for her quite frequently. And this dynamic, you know, we grew up together, one remained poor while the other rises in status. That's a trope that's still repeated quite a bit. Because it's just a natural tension.
Bertha wants Winzy to get a job so that he could make some do-re-mi and they could get married. But Winzy's like, I'm honest if I'm poor. Were I not, I might soon become rich. To that, Bertha just rolls her eyes and says, you know, get some work from that wizard. He offered you a bunch of dough to work from. And you're just scared of him, and that's why you won't marry me, is because you're just scared of some little old wizard.
Yeah.
Go do it. Go get that job.
Shelley's whole treatment of this relationship is pretty comical. And you see that right away.
Yeah.
When he introduces Bertha, we first see her through Winsey's eyes, and he says she's this dark-haired girl with beaming eyes, and you suspect that she'll be another suffering woman of super virtue like Elizabeth was. But no, she's like,
no, she's not.
You got to have a J-O-B if you want to be with me. Not only that, after he tells her why he doesn't want to work with Cornelius, she totally baits him. She goes, you pretend to love and you fear to face the devil for my sake, which is cold because we're talking about the devil.
The devil.
I mean, that's the ultimate bad guy. You won't even face down the devil for me. Nobody can face down the devil. It's the devil.
But I won't do that. So he sucks it up and goes to work for Cornelius. He makes bank over the next few years, but Bertha is what you would call a complicated woman.
Sure.
I love this bit here. It says, Bertha fancied that love and security were enemies, and her pleasure was to divide them in my bosom. Though true of heart, she was somewhat of a coquette in manner, and I was jealous as a Turk. She slighted me 1,000 ways, yet would never acknowledge herself to be in the wrong. She would drive me mad with anger and then force me to beg her pardon.
Mm.
Oh, I remember these ladies.
Yeah.
But he's in love. So what are you going to do?
Well, the worst is it says she was surrounded by silk-clad youths, the rich and gay. What chance had the sad-robed scholar of Cornelius compared with these? So, I mean, there's fellas circulating around, and she's manipulating.
Yeah.
Manipulating that circumstance to make him feel bad. But, you know, when you're young, you'll put up with it. My very first girlfriend was like that when I was in high school. You know, I mean, I'd like, you know, kissed girls, or you go with somebody for a day or something. But it was like the first girlfriend I had. You know, we were together for a few months, which is an enormous amount of time when you're 14 years old.
Oh, yeah.
But she would kind of flirt with other guys and stuff to make me jealous all the time. I'll never forget one night, an older guy who could drive in the middle of the night drove his car through my front lawn, you know, my parents' front lawn. He came by and like yard carved it, you know, where you go in and you squeal out and it just rips up all the sod and everything.
Yeah.
Really mean thing to do to somebody.
Yes.
I was pretty upset that guy did that to me because I didn't even know him, but I knew it was some guy that she used to flirt with. Anyway, I, you know, through my little preteen intelligence, I found out she was in the car with him when it happened. They were laughing at me out there.
So sorry, dude. So sorry.
And I'd like to think that I came back and said, how dare you do something like that? I never want to talk to you again, but I think I went out with her for another month or something like that, you know.
That was really cold of me to do that.
What? It was you?
I feel bad. Yeah. I was a cruel teenager. Wait, just for the record, that was not me. I could not drive.
Right.
I'm not that much older than you.
You tried to do that with your 10-speed once, but it was very impressive. But my girlfriend was on your handlebars, which was impressive.
So Bertha was getting more and more annoyed with him working all the time, and she was just around these rich guys that were wooing her.
I can't believe she gets annoyed with him working too much. He went to work to win her over.
You can't win, not with Bertha. Mm-mm. One time he was supposed to meet her, and he couldn't get away from his duties. When he finally did, she was ticked at him for being late.
The writing here is like uncut fuel for a blues song. It says, when at last I stole out during the few short minutes allotted me for slumber. He's gotten into his sleep time here.
Yeah.
She received me with disdain and vowed that any man should possess her hand rather than he who could not be in two places at once for her sake. In her defense, she is being impossible.
Yeah.
Shame on him for putting up with it. That nobody can be in two places at once. I mean, I guess if she wanted to go out with Dr. Manhattan, that would really be her only choice.
So Cornelius is working on his project, a love cure. Cornelius hasn't slept in 3 days, just mixing and brewing and getting this thing ready. Finally, he tells Winsey, watch this stuff. I gotta sleep. It's been 3 days. It's gonna change color, and then it's gonna do some fancy stuff. But when it changes color, before it does the fancy stuff, wake me up.
Yeah.
He says, Winsey, my boy, do not touch the vessel. Do not put it to your lips. It is a filter to cure love. You would not cease to love your Bertha. Beware to drink.
Hmm.
Like, he knows what he would be thinking. He's like, oh, yeah, you're having problems with this girl that you're in love with, and she's bad for you. This isn't going to help you. So don't drink it. Don't even think about drinking it. I got to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So he goes to sleep. Guess what happens? Well, Winsey's watching the stuff. Bertha and some hunky guy go by this place that he's working, and it seems like she's laughing and pointing at the place where he's working.
Yeah.
Or in the general direction with this rich guy.
Yeah, get off my lawn, I say. I know what she's up to.
And Winsy gets all fired up and he thinks that she's a jerk. And now that she's rich, she can treat him any way that she wants. Forget her. She sucks. I'm cutting her loose. And he thinks, I'm drinking this thing. Even though he said, don't drink the thing. I told you not to do it.
A bright flash darted before my eyes. I'd forgotten the medicine of the adept. I gazed on it with wonder. Flashes of admirable beauty, more bright than those which the diamond emits when the sun's rays are on it, glanced from the surface of the liquid. An odor, the most fragrant and grateful, stole over my sense. The vessel seemed one globe of living radiance, lovely to the eye and most inviting to the taste. The first thought, instinctively inspired by the grosser sense, was, I will, I must drink. I raised the vessel to my lips. It will cure me of love, of torture. Already, I had quaffed half of the most delicious liquor ever tasted by the palate of man when the philosopher stirred. I started. I dropped the glass. The fluid flamed and glanced along the floor while I felt Cornelius's gripe at my throat as he shrieked aloud, Wretch! You've destroyed the labor of my life!
Now, Cornelius thinks that he just dropped it and he doesn't know that Winsy actually drank the stuff. He just thinks he picked it up and then dropped it. That's an assumption that Cornelius makes, and Winsy just doesn't correct him on it.
No.
So he's like, man, I feel awesome. This stuff kicks ass. I don't know what it is, but it just makes me feel great. And Cornelius is such a great philosopher that he just sort of goes, meh, these things happen. Kind of lets it slide right away. Mm-hmm. He goes, I'll just get back to work on it. You know what? Take the rest of the day off. In fact, take a few days off because I got a lot of work to do to get this thing started again.
Yeah, pretty amazing that he's so easygoing or that he's able to cool down so fast. But I suppose if you can only get one employee, you know, you do have to be somewhat forgiving. They drop your stuff.
But when he's out there, he's feeling awesome. The sky is bluer. There's a spring in his step. Everything smells better. And his sadness about Bertha is gone. Mm. When he's walking out, he thinks this elixir is just the best stuff. I don't know what it's supposed to do exactly, but I feel great. He doesn't have a care in the world, and then he sees Bertha running up to him. For the first time, he doesn't feel bad or mad even. He's just cool. Everything's great. And he even thinks, oh, that poor girl. She's distressed. She's running up to me. She's got some problems, but guess what? Her rich lady problems ain't my problems anymore. She's gonna have to go marry some rich dude. Whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, because she's saying, I'm so upset. You know, this woman that took me in, she's saying I have to marry this rich guy or she's gonna boot me. Yeah. And the rich guy, by the way, it's the guy that she cut up his lawn with. That's who she's supposed to marry. So boo-hoo.
And as he listens to her pleas, he realizes, Winsy goes, oh, wait, actually, I do care about her, and I'm still in love with her. No! Yeah. This stuff doesn't work.
It's bad, too. It says her eyes flashing fire, her cheeks glowing with impatience and anger. She was 1,000 times more graceful and charming than ever. Oh, no. Oh. He falls even deeper.
So he takes her and he says, let's be poor and happy together. And she agrees.
She says, take me to poverty and happiness. So that's surprising.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's willing to give up the posh stuff. I didn't expect that.
No.
But I think it's partly because she doesn't like being told what to do by the old lady. And partly, I think she realizes once she says, I'll do what I want, and everybody turns on her, that Winsy is actually her only friend.
Yeah.
So she's got to keep him around, whatever it is she has to do. But there is some love there.
Honestly, Yeah. Well, she definitely loves him. I mean, and we're going to find out through the rest of the story.
Yeah.
They're married the next day. He quits working for Cornelius, but he still is friends with the guy. The effects of the potion seem to wear off, and he feels normal again. But he's still, you know, just kind of an upbeat guy, and life is good.
Yeah.
5 years on, he gets word Cornelius is dying, so he goes over to talk to him, and he's in a bad way. He's been working on another potion, and it's almost done. Winsy doesn't have the heart to tell him that it doesn't work, but he asks Cornelius how a cure for love will stop him from dying. And he says, a cure for love? Oh, a cure for love in all things, the elixir of immortality. If now I might drink, I should live forever. And then I'm like, what? That is a strange way to describe a potion of immortality as the cure for love.
And how exactly does it cure love anyway?
It doesn't. Not at all.
Cornelius is just a prankster, I think. Like, this potion is tasty, Cornelius, so it makes a person famous, huh? Oh, I'm just calling it the fame-making potion. What it really does is make your eyes shoot blood constantly. But as a side effect, you should become fairly well-known, so... Tra-la!
Anyway, it's just about done, and it does the flashy thing that it did before, and Winsy gets it, and he's going to hand it to Cornelius, but the thing sort of explodes up in this flash, and then it disintegrates. He's just like, oh, whoa, that didn't happen before. That's weird. And then he goes to Cornelius, and Cornelius is dead. Not from the explosion, just that fact that he was old and died.
But he wasn't able to drink his immortality potion in time.
So Winsy thinks, I guess I'm immortal. Okay, great. But he's not really sure because he's like, I don't feel any different. Cornelius was kind of an old nutty guy, so he might have been full of beans. Whatever. And he just kind of goes on with his life and doesn't really think much about it.
Right. And he's turned into something of a skeptic over time anyway. You know, people all told him that he couldn't work with Cornelius because of the demons and whatnot.
Yeah.
But he says, no, his science was simply human. He wasn't friends with any demons. He wasn't friends with any spirits except those that are, you know, flesh and blood.
Yeah.
So this immortality thing is likely also
BS.
Not a big deal. He just made a good energy drink. That's all it is.
Yeah. But the years went on and he noticed Bertha got older and he really didn't.
Mm-mm.
This made her uneasy, as she noticed as well. They had no children, so all they had were each other. And she would get jealous, and as she got older, would become more bitter. Finally, when she was 50, he was also 50, but he looked 20, and people were talking. Because since he worked with the old wizard, some thought maybe he was doing some devil magic or hanging out with demons or whatever. So he was shunned. He couldn't find work or sell his crops, so he had to go for miles away to sell things because there nobody would know him, and his reputation wouldn't have followed.
And she's poking him about his youth. Trying to make it into a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, she says she conjured me to cast off the spell. She described how much more comely gray hairs were than my chestnut locks. She descanted on the reverence and respect due to age, how preferable to the slight regard paid to mere children. Well, she's really good at flipping the script, right?
She is.
She also is saying, you know, people are getting upset because they see you're young and I might be stoned as your accomplice, even though I'm aging. I didn't get any benefit from it at all. You didn't share that with me.
Bertha begged him to share a secret, but he can't make her young. And he says, yeah, look, what happened was I drank a potion that the old wizard made. It made me young. I can't remake it. We're stuck. I'm sorry. I'm going to leave, actually. I love you, but me being here is just ruining your life. And they might come for you with pitchforks and then we'll be dead. You'd be better off without me and your friends will come back. And Bertha says, no, I love you. Let's run away together where no one knows us. And he agrees to do it.
They get out of there.
And I thought for some reason they would go the mother-son route, but they don't do that.
No, which could have been creepy, although I kind of hoped it would happen just because I was thinking, what a great way to start the story if you were a third person, you know, if you didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, you saw the mother and son, like, do their act, and then in secret they start making out or something. You go, oh, God, what's happening? And then to find out it's actually, you know, this beautiful love story would have been a kind of a cool angle, I think. But instead of taking on these different roles, they just try to mask things.
Right. Yeah, he tries to age up a bit, you know, look older, and then she tries to age down. It says, she sought to decrease the apparent disparity in our ages by 1,000 feminine arts, rouge, youthful dress, and assumed juvenile manner. I could not be angry. Did not I myself wear a mask? Why quarrel with hers because it was less successful?
Mm.
This worked to a degree, but never really. She was always jealous of his youth and often told him that he would have to pay his due at some point, that perhaps he would age quickly one day, or that maybe his insides were aging and he would die on the spot, but he looked young. And just, you know, she tried to undercut this thing that he had going on. And he was always nice about it. And he's like, well, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe those things will happen to me. I don't know. But maybe I'll get what's coming to me and you'll be vindicated. But he kind of knew that wasn't the case.
Right. He just felt good. He knew that was
And he humored her, to kind of make her feel better.
Even this bit with the gray hair that he talks about in the beginning. Yeah, he thinks, well, that might have already been there, actually. And I'm just like...
So eventually she got old and bedridden and he took care of her. But eventually she dies. And then he had to figure out what to do. So he traveled, he had some adventures, but he got bored pretty quick and eventually he hoped to die. He's not really sure he's immortal, as he was saying kind of at the beginning of the story. He might just be very long-lived since he only drank half of the potion. So he might only live half an eternity, but then again, half of infinity is still infinity, so who knows?
Yeah.
He wants to die, but he's afraid of death. So no suicide for him. What does he do? You know, that's kind of why he calls himself the mortal immortal, because he is desirous of death, yet never dying.
There you go. I think that's the point of the oxymoron.
Yeah.
But I thought this was interesting because he might actually be mortal. Often in these stories, you have the cursed immortal trying suicide because they get so tired of it and they just don't succeed. I think that even happened in Groundhog Day.
Oh, yeah, a bunch.
After he's repeated the day so many times, he thinks this will never end. So he starts trying to kill himself, but it doesn't work. But this guy doesn't really know that. He may die if somebody kills him, or if he starves, or if the elements get to him, or if he kills himself. In 300 years, he hasn't tried any of these things or been exposed to that type of danger, which is kind of novel in this type of story. And it shows how, I think what she's trying to get across is we'll cling to life even if it's terrible. So, it's that I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. He's not going to pursue his own mortality, even though he's sick of his immortality. But finally, I think he comes to the conclusion that he needs to.
So Winsey has a little ego, and he thinks about trying to make a name for himself, make some kind of great discovery, like going up to the North Pole, not unlike Walton and Frankenstein. And he writes all this stuff to sort of make his mark in history.
Before I go, a miserable vanity has caused me to pen these pages. I would not die and leave no name behind. 3 centuries have passed since I quaffed the fatal beverage. Another year shall not elapse before, encountering gigantic dangers, warring with the powers of frost in their home, beset by famine, toil, and tempest, I yield this body, too tenacious a cage for a soul which thirsts for freedom, to the destructive elements of air and water. Or, if I survive, my name shall be recorded as one of the most famous among the sons of men. And, my task achieved, I shall adopt more resolute means, and by scattering and annihilating the atoms that compose my frame, set at liberty the life imprisoned within, and so cruelly prevented from soaring from this dim earth to a sphere more congenial to its immortal essence.
And that's the end of the story.
He's going to go on some sort of expedition. I thought maybe there'd be a chapter 2,
Yeah, no.
Flipped over to the next page and there was nothing.
That's it.
But this is happening in 1833, his story. Victor and Walton, they were out on the ice in 1799.
Yeah.
So it was, 30 years prior. Maybe after the creature left the ship, he couldn't go through with the pyre thing.
Mm-hmm.
He went through the same kind of conflict as this guy.
Yeah.
Even though I'm craving death. Because, his whole rap at the end here sounds a lot like the creature's.
Yeah.
Even if I come back and I'm famous and I've accomplished anything, I'm going to adopt more resolute means and scatter the atoms that compose my frame so that I'm somehow at liberty. He says it. It's basically setting yourself on fire.
Mm-hmm.
But is he going to do it? I don't know. Maybe the monster didn't do it. He just froze.
Right.
So this guy goes out and he does his expedition and he finds him.
Oh, okay.
He thaws the creature out.
All right.
And he's like, yo, we're both immortal.
Oh, wow.
Now the creature has a companion who at least understands part of his dilemma.
Sure.
And they can go pick up that trickster dwarf from Transformation. Boom. Shelleyverse,
All right. Yeah.
Shelley's Angels. I don't know what we call them. the merry men. But then they all three... They go on adventures.
Oh, that's Mary is an M-A-R-Y, not M-E-R-R-Y.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, obviously, Shelley liked her mad scientist. She liked thinking about these kinds of topics, so there's probably plenty of other characters to draw from. Not that anybody needs another shared universe, but... so on the thing you mentioned earlier about immortality, why do you think it's been beaten to death? What were you talking about?
Vampire stories, specifically. And Highlander, the idea that you are just around and that eventually you'll get bored or... The heartbreak of losing your loved ones will get to you. Those are kind of the common tropes with immortality.
Right.
To me, I feel like they're both BS because with losing people close to you, you're still going to get close to other people.
Yeah.
Like that's just the nature of humans. I mean, throughout our life, we meet new people and we become close to them and other people kind of drift away. And that's just life. And if it's your family you want to be close to, you'll be around for your grandchildren and your great grandchildren and those children after that. Like there'll always be other generations. So if your family keeps having kids, at least. And so there is that.
I always liked the Logan immortality where he forgets things too,
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because I feel like you wouldn't have the elasticity of mind to retain after a certain amount of time, you would just be living in that present. Obviously, you would learn things or have memories, but I think it would get really fuzzy.
Oh, I think for sure. Well, it happens to anybody, as they get older. And if you stretch out your life over... I'm sure you would still remember things from your childhood very vividly, but there would be...
Yeah, if someone drove through your lawn or something, you'd probably forget it. But...
But
everything else,
The 220s, you probably just don't remember anything about them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's things like that now. Sure. There's a lot of the aughts. I go, what happened?
220. I lived in Budapest. I did that for 10 years. I don't remember doing that.
With this guy, he gets the immortality and he does get a little bit of a boosted, metabolism, or maybe it's just got a Prozac kind of effect. Like he's got, he just feels a little better.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be so scared. You go, I want immortality. Okay. But then they don't do anything to keep you. Like, you just keep aging. but you never die. That's what I think would be the worst possible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but no story ever has.
You get elderly, and then you know, you're kind of just a walking puddle of corpse stuff, but yeah, you're still living.
No, they don't ever do that in the story. Maybe there's a story out there that somebody's done that. But typically, especially in these vampire things, it's always about the anguish of existence, like being around. And that's the other thing. There's always new stuff to check out. You can, maybe you've traveled everywhere in the world, but places change. You know, Paris 100 years ago is not the Paris now.
Right.
So if you're sticking around, you can just keep going around the world to all these different places, and they're going to keep changing, and there's going to be different things. And think of how different humanity is from 100 years ago, like just how different the world is.
Yeah.
And how different it's going to be 100 years from now.
Well, I think Shelley's right to have the elixir give you a positive attitude, too, because that's what you'd need to continue to be interested in this stuff, though. I mean, I could see that if you had a miserable outlook on life, then the more life you got would be the more time to ponder how wrong everything is.
I feel like with age, and I could be wrong because I'm not that old, but I'm getting older, and I remember my youth, and I see how I sort of look at the world now, especially having children, that you're sort of making way for the next generation, and you feel like eventually you're going to gracefully go out. You know, like, you'll die. I'm going to die eventually. Everybody will. If somebody offered me the chance to be immortal, I don't think it is a curse. Is what they often say. It's not a blessing, it's a curse.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I think it's pretty cool.
I think these stories endeavor to make you think riches and immortality and a lot of these things would be terrible because you're never going to get them. So we should probably make them look like bad options.
Right. Sour grapes.
It's like every story about someone rich and famous never ends well, because if it did, then you'd be even more depressed.
Right. But next week...
Yeah, what's going on next week?
We're moving away from Shelley. We've spent enough time with her for now. Maybe we'll go back to her. But, you know, some of the themes in Frankenstein I thought we should tackle. So one of our listeners told us about a story called And the Dead Spake by E.F. Benson. So we're going to check that one out. That has got some maybe similar themes to the Frankenstein novel.
Cool. I look forward to reading that. I want to thank David Wildsmith once again for doing our readings today.
You are a trooper.
Once again, he's one of the fellows behind the Seven Land Hand podcast at sevenlandhand.com. Please check that out. We'll be back next week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.